Today, some thoughts about house prices. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Now, you've been wielding that pen of yours, and you penned a very, very interesting piece on house prices and what might drive them.
Indeed. I was quite surprised at the fantastic reaction to that. You know, it was something that was published independently. It's been over 10,000 people have looked at it, and that's just a fantastic response from the community on Twitter and everyone else who appreciated it.
Well, I thought it was really interesting because you actually did start teasing out some really, really important issues, right? And, you know, there's a lot of top-level noise about house prices. You know, CoreLogic came out today and said, well, they probably dropped 10%. You got Christopher Joy saying they're going to be up 30%. You've got some of the mainstream analysts saying they're down 20%. My own view is it could be worse than that. So there's massive amounts of divergence. And, of course, part of it is, well, it depends a bit on how the virus plays out and how much damage is done to the economy. But there's a bunch of other factors that you started pointing to as they've got to think about these too. So maybe we could just go through the main points in the discussion. We'll put a link below to the article that you published previously.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's one of the key things going forward is just looking at the situation for housing and unemployment through the lens of demographics and how different things are from 2008. Because a lot of people keep pointing to the 90s recession or to 2008, or even some people as far back as the 1987 stock market crash to say, oh, look, it's fine. Housing prices are going to bounce. You know, everything's going to be back to normal. But the thing is, things are remarkably different now to then. You know, like the average baby boomer in 2008 was in their early to mid 50s. Today, the average baby boomer is 65. And we know from all manner of surveys that they are the largest holder of investment properties of any demographic, followed by people aged 45 to 54. So I think one of the fundamental questions that needs to be asked is, what is the incentive to hold a property? One, if you're retired, and two, if you've lost your job, and you're in that sort of demographic that's going to struggle to recapture to get back into the workforce. There's this fantastic graph, one which I sent you, that shows how many people actually managed to get back into the workforce in the different age groups during the GFC in America. And it's remarkable the number of older people who never worked again. And considering that we're heading into a similar period of economic upheaval, the question is there any incentive for these people to continue holding investment properties when there's no income to negatively gear against, or there's no real sort of big, there's no more FOMO. There's no more, oh my God, if I don't sell now, you know, I'm going to miss out or whatever. There's not going to be any more, let's going to have 7, 10, 15% housing price rises, at least on the horizon that retirees are going to be considering. And without that incentive, for these, you know, however many people it ends up being, you know, I mean, the Grattan Institute is talking about 3.43 million people becoming unemployed. And how many of them are going to decide, well, you know what, I'm just going to pull up sticks, bank the money, you know, stuff the piggy bank, you know, yeah, I'm not going to get good returns in the share market or anything or anywhere else, but I'm going to have the money to support myself. And more importantly, with the higher pension age now as well, now being 67, it's also the incentive to be able to put the money aside to support yourself until you reach that age.
Yeah, well, I talk about these as down traders. So they're people with those property portfolios. Their main priority now is to get equity out. And if indeed the expectation is that prices are going to fall, then that means they're more likely rather than less likely to try and sell sooner rather than later, because the longer they leave it, the worse it's going to get in terms of the price falls. And so we're seeing quite a proportion of those people actually saying, I'm going to try and transact. You know, even if I have to cut the price a bit, I want to get out, I want to get that equity. So you're spot on. Also, of course, a lot of those people still have mortgages. So the other demographic shift is that, you know, it used to be that by you get to mid-50s and then you've paid off your mortgage. Now people are going into retirement with mortgage or mortgages, sometimes investment mortgages too. But of course, servicing those when the income is being squeezed is a completely different kettle of fish, especially when if you've got rental properties, you're not getting the returns that you used to because, you know, typical rentals in Sydney are dropping quite significantly. We've got much more supply. We've got 30,000 rental properties in the Sydney area on the listings at the moment, which is very high. And we know that there are more coming, Airbnb, a few others as well. So, you know, the whole rental strategy has gone a bit off, and I'm not sure it's going to come back anytime soon. I know, you know, interest rates are low, but frankly, there are other costs of managing and holding a rental property that people have to deal with as well. So yeah, I think you're spot on in terms of that demographic shift. The other question I've got for you though is migration, because of course we've had massive migration over the recent times, and 300,000 each year, and that's been one of the other drivers to the property sector. But of course, migration is zero at the moment. And so I wonder whether we're actually going to see another shift insofar that maybe the population levels that we thought we were going to get, we won't get to. Or do you think it's likely that once we get the other side of the virus, the government will then say, open the taps, we need more migration, more, because we need more people, because that's the only growth lever we've got, in which case demand for property might accelerate?
I mean, it's always possible. You know, you can never say never when it comes to the property prime minister. And I think the thing with immigration is you're already starting to see these articles pressing the idea that we can't grow without migration. We can't grow without migration. And that narrative is already starting to be trotted out. And I don't think it's going to be as successful as its advocates might hope. Because the reality is it's fine pushing, well, it's not fine, but, you know, it's doable to push that narrative when unemployment's got a 5 in front of it. When unemployment has a 10 or an 11 or a 15, whoever knows, you know, who knows where it ends up, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to sell. Because, I mean, even in the NAB half yearly results yesterday, their prediction is of 11.6% unemployment in December. Now, if it's still 11.6% unemployment in December and ScoMo decides to try and reopen the immigration floodgates at more than 20,000 people a month being added to the labor force, people are not going to stand for that. You know, you're already seeing, you know, Pauline Hanson jump on Trump's wagon to say we don't want more migration. We want to get it down. We want to protect Australian workers and protect the, you know, living standards and outcomes. And I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I mean, don't get me wrong, they can do it, and then they can sort of try and hope to spin a narrative to win the next election. But unless somehow they can get tacit support from Labor to pursue that agenda, I have a hard time seeing it.
Hmm. Well, I think, you know, stand back and look over the last 10 years, the two levers that have been used by the government from a policy perspective to support the economy. The first one was essentially cutting interest rates and, you know, more debt, so more household debt in particular. But the other one has been migration. And I would argue that the quantitative easing lever that we've been using is migration for at least a decade. So we've got a much bigger economy in terms of the total number of people. Although if you look at GDP per capita, it's nowhere near as strong. And in fact, there have been a couple of GDP per capita recessions quite recently. So in a way, the story of Australia is a story of bringing more people in and making the numbers look okay off the back of it. But of course, there are consequences of that, as we know from the, you know, very large areas of Sydney and Melbourne in particular, but other places too, where effectively it's very crowded now. And that's changed the strategy in terms of building up with, you know, all of these high-rise apartments and things. So the whole tenor of those locations are being changed by this high migration. But as you say, the big difference now is that if unemployment is at 10% rather than 5%, it's going to be very politically hard to make it fly.
Yeah, I think the thing is that the public was already opposed to mass immigration as it is. You know, Macro Business does a great series of articles. When a new poll comes out, they always say, you know, this number of people, and this is the polls of, you know, going back years and years of people opposing mass migration. But even if you look at the polling surrounding the 2019 election, it was very clear that the people of Australia were already taking an issue with the results of migration. You know, people were saying, you know, we need more funding for hospitals, we need more funding for schools. And while they don't explicitly mention migration as the issue, that's the reason why the state government budgets are stretched, because it's the federal government who sets the immigration intake, and it's the states who need to fund the health, road, and education infrastructure to support these people. And I can't see that sort of continuing, because I mean, we were already seeing some fairly significant pushback from the states against high migration as it was. And now they're going to have, you know, significant shortfalls in revenue from stamp duty, from payroll tax, from all manner of different things. And, you know, they're going to be squeezed on supplying, you know, the infrastructure that we need now, the infrastructure that we're going to need if we want to start importing 300,000 people a year again. And I think another thing as well that's specific as to the Morrison government is you're already sort of seeing the narrative change about the support for the community through this. You know, I mean, Scott Morrison was talking the other day about potentially ending JobKeeper early. Now, that's insane. I think it was just something saying, you know, we think things are going to get better sooner. And it was just sort of a nice little, you know, headline fairy tale to feed people. But I think it speaks to the Morrison government's ideological priorities. You know, they're already talking about how we're going to pay for this debt, how we're going to pay for this debt, or we're going to have to cut this, we're going to have to cut that. And then they're talking about, you know, in order to improve productivity, we're talking about, you know, Corey Bernardi's talking about, you know, cutting the minimum wage. And then we've got, you know, other people talking about cutting corporate taxes and, you know, sort of diminishing the revenue base even more. And it really does make you think. It's like, well, are we all just going to be thrown under the bus? You know, are they just going to, you know, sort of continue these subsidies in the form of things like franking credits and negative gearing and try and kickstart the status quo at everyone else's expense?
Mm. Well, it's really very interesting because, you know, there are people with the MMT tag that says actually borrowing more is good, or, you know, creating more because governments can do that. But of course, the other side of it is MMT only works when you are investing that money into things that are creating growth. And the growth effectively is stronger, and that then effectively allows you to rebalance the budgets, essentially. So the trouble is, if the government is borrowing big as they are, and they're doing it predominantly to support the banking system and, you know, big corporates and everything else, rather than actually creating, investing for the future, it doesn't take you anywhere. It just creates you a future economy with more debt. And, you know, more difficulty. And if you come back around to house prices, you know, the reason that house prices were so powerful for such a long period of time was because the rates of interest were cut. Can't do much more of that now. The lending standards were reduced. Well, they can't reduce them much more than they're reducing them now. So those levers are pretty much gone. If you then turn off the population lever and say, well, maybe we can't get migration to come back, the question then is, well, where is the future growth going to come from? Because it's not going to necessarily come directly from the government. Although, of course, I noticed that New South Wales is talking about having a corporation buy all of the off-the-plan stuff that exists at the moment, because no one has wanted to buy it, right? So they're always going to find a way, aren't they?
Oh, I think they'll try. Yeah. They'll try. And I think that's something that the people have been discussing in sort of, you know, the sort of financial Twitter world is, you know, talking about sort of even further relaxations of lending standards and, you know, sort of ways the government could prop that up. I'm sort of curious to hear your thoughts on what sort of things they could, you know, APRA, the RBA and the government could come up with in order to sort of prop up housing prices.
Oh, I think there's a few. The first is, I think they'll do more in the first-time buyer sector. So the first-time buyers is cannon fodder for keeping house prices up, right? And, you know, they could easily introduce a $100,000 incentive for somebody to come in and buy property. So I would expect a whole bunch of incentives there. I think there will be some discussion about stamp duty. And if they were to, say, remove stamp duty and replace it with a land tax, that creates one less barrier when you transact. So wouldn't be surprised to see that coming through. But I think the other one to think about is what they can do with regards to credit supply. Because, you know, basically you need people to be able to get bigger mortgages if you want to keep house prices high. Now, the only way you can do that is to extend the life of a mortgage. So maybe we'll get a 50-year or 80-year mortgages, intergenerational mortgages, maybe, you know, those sorts of things. Or you take the interest rate even lower. Now, of course, the problem there is if you take rates lower, the banks get to the point where they can't make any money off making a loan, and therefore they tend to stop. So there is some lower bounds there. But there are levers that they can do. But what about providing tax breaks for owner-occupiers, for example? You know, that was done in the UK some years ago to give people effectively a tax break if they had their own property. So, you know, if you really wanted to be creative and if you really were fixated on keeping house prices high, those are some of the things you could do. And there's a reason why you might want to do it, and that is, of course, relates to the bank's portfolios, who have 60 to 70% of their whole lending exposure in the property and construction sectors. And so the last thing you want to do is to let the value of those drop. And I know that the big banks have been provisioning quite, you know, hard at the moment because of COVID. But in a way, if you can keep the home prices higher and still rising higher, you get a wealth effect. You support the banks and the balance sheets. And essentially, you can go to the election saying, see, we've protected you from, you know, the disaster that was going to be there. So you can see the compelling reasons why it is that they will turn in and focus on trying to keep home prices higher. I'm not sure how successful they will be, but I'm sure they give it a good shot.
No, I tend to agree. You know, they're going to try. But I think one of the interesting things going forward is how much scope will they actually have, and how much resources are they going to be willing to put toward those ends? Because I think that there's going to be a lot of different industries crying out for a lot of aid in the months and years going forward. You know, and it's all in good. You know, a lot of people say, you know, like the property lobby is powerful, and they're absolutely right. They very much are. But the big business lobby is arguably equally as powerful. And they're going to want support too. You know, you're going to want, you know, there's going to be, you know, sort of support for retailers, support for, you know, commercial property, support for all these various different things who are going to end up in a really, really horrible situation as time goes on. And I think that the government isn't really a big spending government. I know that's an ironic thing to say, given the fact that they're, you know, sort of, you know, blowing through hundreds of billions a year. But they're not. That's not where they're at ideologically. And while I think they want to support housing prices, I think it may be uneconomical to support them. You know, they may look at it and they go, look, okay, this sucks. We wish that we could save it. But this, however many tens of billions or 100 billion or whatever it is that they feel like it's going to cost, would be better spent elsewhere. And those people give us money in the form of donations as well, and they need to be looked after too.
You're painting an interesting picture where all these different power plays are going in, and then you've got the people in power trying to say, well, who do I placate first? Is it those guys or those guys or those guys over there? Right? I mean, I'm not sure whether that's the way it works. I wonder whether that may be truer than I would prefer not to know about it. But it is quite interesting. And, you know, there will be some limits, right? Because they've already got a bigger debt than they thought they were going to have. And they're going to have to prioritize. But I also make the point that they're only interested in getting to the next election. Right. So there's very little strategic thinking anywhere in Canberra that I see. It's always, oh, I've got to get to the next election and I want to win. So I wonder whether they will be short termist and just do whatever it takes to try and actually get the wealth effect up a little bit in time for the next election.
Quite possibly. I mean, I don't think anything can be ruled out. And I think one of the key things at the moment is that the housing sector isn't being supported as strongly as people might expect. You know, like the general consensus is that, you know, yet they're going to support the housing sector with everything they've got, and maybe that will be true down the road. But you're seeing at the moment, with the basically zero support being given to landlords, residential landlords, that is, that they're not really super high on the list of priorities, at least not yet. Because at the end of the day, the government is too busy being focused on saving the productive economy, because the productive economy is the tax base that they need to pay for all of this. You know, like you're seeing relief for commercial landlords, you know, you're seeing, you know, relief for business owners, because at the end of the day, as not to put too fine a point on it, but those are the people that matter to the economy. Residential landlords don't matter to the economy, not in any great sense. They are a tiny, tiny fraction of real economic activity that actually drives productivity, that drives growth, that does all those important things that a government needs. And at the end of the day, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if in net terms they were a net drain on the government in terms of their coffers. You know, they're not providing much tax revenue. You know, it's the businesses that the government are concerned about protecting. Now, whether that's going to change, in all likelihood, probably. But how much are they going to be willing to spend on that when there's the productive economy crying out and the revenue base crying out? I mean, how can you claim to be a superior economic manager when you're going to blow 50 or 100 billion or however much it costs on saving property prices when there are businesses going bust and real people losing jobs? And that's going to have a negative effect on housing prices anyway, realistically.
Mm. Well, I've always said that the biggest mistake that they could make would be to throw all of their muscle at the property market and try and keep that bubble, because it is a bubble. It's way over, you know, long-term value. The best thing that could be done is to let property prices settle. I know that people are going to have a terrible time with that, but it needs to be done. We need to get the debt. But the other point then is, if you're investing in productive capability for the future, manufacturing capability for the future, those are things that can create more growth later. Because let's face it, investing in property doesn't actually grow the economy, right? No. It doesn't actually create an extra dollar. It's all artificially inflated by the fact that the loans have gone up and therefore the values have gone up, but it's not real. It's illusory. So it's not real wealth. And I'm, you know, really of the view that if we're really going to make a change for the better for the future, we need a much more productive and a much more focused strategy on laying the capabilities out and investing in those capabilities that will actually create growth in the long term. But maybe I'm just too much of an idealist.
Well, realistically, the data says that we are less economically complex than Uganda
yep.
and 92 other countries. So I think it's pretty clear that there needs to be a change.
Mm.
You know, we can try and sort of rekindle the status quo, but realistically, is there any going back? We actually, you know, if we're just going to focus on propping up housing prices and trying to just, you know, dig stuff up out of the ground and sell it to China, and that's going to be our only growth engine forever and ever. You know, I mean, how are we going to get back to where we were? You know, we need to be able to, as the globalized world shifts, and you know, we shift more towards, you know, sort of the national interests rather than sort of, you know, the profits side of things, so to speak. We need to justify our high wages and our high living standards. But if we're economically as complex as Uganda, if we're not careful, we're going to end up with living standards like Uganda.
Yeah.
So we need a long-term plan rather than just, you know, betting on China, betting on housing prices and hoping for the best.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always said strategy is what we're talking about here, and there's very little strategy down the road in Canberra. I've always felt they've been very tactical. But there is an opportunity if people want to grasp it. But, you know, it's going to be a limited window opportunity. And I just hope that people make the right decisions, not the wrong decisions, and just don't try and go back to where we were previously and hope that it can just magically play out. Because we were already laying horrible bear traps for households with high levels of debt and high house prices. And if we just go back to that, then we've lost the plot completely. But I guess we'll have to watch and wait and see.
I agree. And just a point on the sort of housing price side of things.
Hmm.
I think one of the key things is that a lot of people are focusing on forced sales.
Yep.
On people being forced by the bank to, you know, to go to a mortgaging auction to sell their home. And yeah, I think that will be a factor down the road. But I think it may be quite a while with all the various different things being put in place, all the different hardship provisions. And the banks are, from what I understand, being relatively accommodating, at least in terms of preventing that sort of outcome. But I think the point that people are missing is people who are going to sell deliberately,
yep,
who are not going to be forced, who are going to do it to as you say, to unlock equity, to safeguard retirements, to downsize, to do all these different things once the possibility of further capital appreciation evaporates. I don't think that this is going to be a housing price decline driven by forced sales. It's going to be driven by people who make that decision themselves. Because at the end of the day, without the without that massive upside there, without that sort of, you know, that narrative still flowing through the veins of middle Australia that somehow everything's always going to be fine and that housing prices are always going to rise, when you take that Australian exceptionalism and property exceptionalism narrative out of the equation, you remove the incentive to hold property as an investment unless you've got yourself a winner that's positively geared, that's providing a good income, or, you know. And I think that's really, really key going forward, both from a demographic perspective and even just from, you know, younger landlords. You know, if you bought a house, you know, say 5, 6, 7 years ago, you may have big, big equity in that property and you may not want to lose that. You're going to look at that and you're going to say, well, look, I can either accept that I'm going to lose X amount of dollars per week with my negative gearing, I'm still not positively geared, or I could sell and walk away with $300,000. And you just go, well, in this environment, maybe I'll just take the money.
Yep. Well, I don't know whether you saw, I did a post a couple of weeks ago on forced sales, and I separated out those from the bank, very low proportion, right? And those, as you say, who are of the view that they should try and sell. 8% of property investors, 8% were in that category. So trying to get out, release equity, and about 2% of owner-occupied owners, a lot of those being the down traders. So they're the people who are smart enough to see the writing on the wall and trying to get out quickly before value decays further. But it's nothing at the moment to do with banks. I think banks, we won't see forced closures from the banks for at least 6 months, probably longer, because any of those mortgage repayments that are on the holiday, the banks don't have to disclose those as bad loans. So they just keep them ticking over. They will then go through some hardship programs that take a few months. So I would have thought that probably next year will be the start of the bank foreclosures. Although, interestingly, NAB's results yesterday showed that the delinquencies were actually up a bit relative to what was happening previously, and that was before the virus really hit. And the same with the S&P spin index. The delinquencies were up a little bit higher as well. So there were always the seeds there, but I think the forced sales will be somewhat down the track. Another reason why I think prices are going to fall rather than rise ahead.
No, I completely agree. And I think, you know, even just you making the point of, you know, sort of 8% of investors, you know, looking to get out of the market. In the current environment, that even pre-coronavirus, housing turnover was near sort of historic lows over the last few decades.
Yep.
You know, you're not seeing the sort of like mid-2000s level of, you know, sort of 7, 8% housing turnover. It's more like 4, 4.5 to 5. So it's not going to take much to move the needle from sort of a neutral position into housing price falls. You know, I mean, if even say, I don't know, say half of those investors decide to sell in the next 12 months, you know, that in itself could start, you know, a sort of wave of housing price falls.
Yeah.
quite easily.
And what tends to happen, Tarek, is that you start seeing prices fall and then more people say, oh, I need to sell quickly because if I wait, I'm going to lose more money. So it's a reinforcing downward spiral, just as in the good times you see a reinforcing upward spiral. And that sort of feedback loop, which becomes a psychological thing as well as just an economic thing, can also explain why it is that when you see these moves down, they tend to be quite dramatic. And they tend to accelerate. So typically, if you look at the US, it took 3 years from the global financial crisis for home prices to reach their bottom. So this is not necessarily something that's going to be just a few months and then suddenly we'll be off again, right? This could be a 2 to 3 year grind down. And at the end of it, you could well end up with more households in negative equity, more people struggling to sell, being forced to sell and taking a loss, and bank losses also rising. So, you know, that is definitely a live scenario that I'm looking at the moment in my modelling. Not the only one, but I think it's probably relatively realistic.
No, I completely agree. I think one of the things as well is that people talk about property and they say, oh, the government will save us. No, the government will save us, the Liberal Party will save us, the property investor will save us. And I just feel like saying to them, it's like, okay, yes, they are interested in property. Yes, they don't want prices to fall. But look at JobKeeper. Look at how long it's taken for these policies to actually get money into the hands of people who need it. Look how late it came. Look at America. Look at how many businesses applied for these loans. 95% of them didn't get a dollar. You know, you're relying on the government in a crisis who's ideologically biased towards the support of its traditional base and its traditional interests to hope that property will bounce back in the middle of a global pandemic with more than 10% unemployment. Now, when I put all those things together, it sounds a little bit crazy.
Yeah, well, that's why your paper, I think, got so much of a rap, because it really did spell all of these issues out very clearly. And I appreciate your time today taking us through it. And as I say, we'll put the link below so that people can go and read it for themselves. But thanks very much for your time today, Tarek. Very interesting.
Cheers, Martin.
See you soon. Cheers, bye.
Bye.
So there you are. As Tarek has shown, there's a lot of crosswinds with regard to where home prices may go. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.